All right, so we're going to get started here, and it's time to get started with the next presentation. Welcome back to the presentations here. As a reminder, all of the presentations are being recorded on the audio, so please, when you have questions at the end, step up to the mic so we can get that. You also get copies of the presentations. You can find all that information on page 3 of your show guide. With that, I will introduce to you Stephen Schmalz from RSA to talk about trusted cryptography modules and malware encryption.
Thank you. So thank you all for coming. So when I put together this this presentation, didn't quite know what I was getting into. Last year when I attended a conference, the last couple of years, I was struck by the change in the industry in the last 20 to 30 years that I've been involved. When I left government and joined RSA, I joined to support the selling of their cryptographic tools, BSafe. Some of you may remember the product. And working at RSA through the years, I saw the company evolve from focused on authentication to encryption to spreading out to multiple other offerings in the security space. And if you've been to the RSA conference, and by the way, I'm not trying to make this an RSA specific thing, I'm just talking about the industry in general, but if you've been to the RSA conference, which is an industry conference, by the way, just be an RSA person and try to get a talk accepted there. It's almost impossible. Far prefer somebody else. But you can see the same thing. When I first started going, there was a lot of authentication, access management, encryption, and as the if you went last year or the two or three years before that, you've seen government risk and compliance, and you've seen tons and tons of tools for security operations centers to help find malware, to keep advanced persistent threats from doing damage. You've seen a real evolution in security products that are made available, and you've seen a change in focus. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that's the correct change in focus. We may have swung too far away from focusing on the core tools like encryption and authentication and access management to the effort to watch for malware being installed on the system, for watching and hunting for the bad guys. But in observing this, I've always thought there must be a better way for sort of the two worlds to cooperate with each other. And so in some sense, that's what this talk is about. And so I'm worried in some respects as I get into this talk and as I start sort of giving you my ideas and going through the topic of malware and trusted cryptographic modules and encryption. You know, am I going to be telling you something that you already know about? Am I going to be talking about potential initiatives that may already be going on out there? I'm sure other people have thought of the kinds of things I'm going to talk about today. But I still think it's a conversation worth having. So let me get started by talking about malware encryption. Now, I say here talented amateurs. I'm not talking about their talent in producing malware, although there were a lot of amateurs involved in the beginning. What I'm talking about is their use of encryption. If you gave the problem of how to protect malware, how to obfuscate it, how to prevent people from recognizing it on your system to a group of professionals, you would get something completely different than what you've got. That being said, it works really well. So when you're talking about malware encryption, and by the way, as I started researching this, most of this information I gathered talking to fellow professionals at my company, people I know through the standards groups, Googling things on the internet, some personal experience. Don't look at me as an expert. And in fact, when I first started doing this, I was hoping I would find a paper that was a survey of the use of encryption in malware. That'd be a fantastic source to use for this talk. Well, I couldn't find one. If there is one, let me know about it. And if anybody's thinking of writing one, if it turns out I'm right and there isn't one, I think it'd be a great project. But back to the topic at hand. So the malware first used encryption in an effort to obfuscate itself. I mean, you all know what the problem is if you're developing malware. It's to keep people from finding you on the systems that you're trying to infect and leak data from or institute a ransomware attack. So initially, it was one of the multiple ways that malware used to change itself. So the classic sort of signature-based technology, you know, of hashing different parts of a piece of malware code and then using that to try to identify it. It worked pretty well. In fact, if you ask people today how does signature-based malware detection work, the answer is, well, you still need it, but unfortunately, most of the modern malware is able to work its way around that. And part of that's by using encryption. And by the way, I didn't go into detail. I'm sure you probably know what I mean by obfuscation. The malware encrypts itself. And it's able to decrypt itself when necessary. In fact, there are much more sophisticated things that it can do. And just by tweaking the way the encryption is done, it looks different every time. So the next use of encryption in malware, and I'm sure you're familiar with Zeus, if not SpyEye. It was the use of encryption to protect the command control. So when the malware is deployed, when botnets are deployed, as you all know, they need to talk to some central or distributed control centers in order to leak information out, basically command control chatter. And surprising to me, and it shouldn't have been that big of a surprise, it was RC4 that was used. So why was RC4 used? Well, small, self-contained bit of code, easy to program, easy to use to encrypt the data that's being transmitted as malware talks to its command and control centers. And if you look at it, in fact, and this is sort of where I got the talented amateur impression from looking at the use of encryption, they do some funky multiple XORs with RC4 thrown in there. And if you do a little bit more research, you'll find out that, you know, they didn't need to make sure that their encryption methodology protected them against nation states. They needed to make sure they just weren't found. In fact, if you know the malware is there, it doesn't really matter how good its encryption is in some instance, because if you know it's there, you're going to get rid of it. So the whole idea is just to do something quick and dirty to keep you from finding it. In the case of obfuscation, it was to keep you from finding the file. In the case of encrypting the command and control, it's to keep you from noticing that it's talking and chattering on your networks. So as nice as that is, again, the point is that malware doesn't want to be found. And if it's doing its own encryption, if it doesn't look like anything else that's doing encryption on your networks, that might be one way that you might notice it. So sort of in the next phase of development, if you want to sort of think of it in this way, malware started to take advantage of SSL TLS. Now the difference here and what happened before is that you weren't going to embed OpenSSL in your little nuggets of malware code. That's not very practical. So it has to leverage the libraries that are on the system. And that's exactly what it's done. So that's a quick summary of malware and the use of encryption. Notice I didn't go into any great details about the 15 or 16 different algorithms and varieties of algorithms. I actually was hoping I'd find interesting stuff like this. It's very straightforward. Scores, you know, stream ciphers for protecting, keeping you from finding it, keeping you from finding it on the network, and the use of SSL and TLS to protect itself, leveraging resources on the platforms that it's installed itself. So this slide is just a quick summary, but it also allows me to talk a little bit about what, in fact, if I could, can I go back real quick here? So this section is the challenge for the professionals. Now you've all seen those slides, right, that talk about the advantage of the hacker against the white hats, the black hats against the white hats, right? The black hats only have to be right once. The white hats have to be right all the time. So this is sort of the idea of the professional. I mean, you have a large number of people who are trying to find malware. So what effect does this encryption have? I already mentioned a little bit about the motivation for encryption, but what actual effect does it have? So a quick little summary of what happens today in your security operations centers. There's sort of three main avenues of attack, and none of this should be surprising. It all makes sense, right? You either look at the endpoints, you look at the network traffic, or you look at logs. Those are the three places that you look for abnormal behavior. You look for something sticking out saying, this doesn't quite look right. My normal network processes, my normal applications don't work this way. So, just as a quick summary, use of encryption on endpoints or malware is to obfuscate it. Although, today, there are advanced analytic techniques, rootkits, you sometimes hear called, that are able to watch processes on your local endpoints and can notice malware without having to identify a particular signature. And that code works pretty well, which means that malware, you can still find malware even if it's encrypting itself and obfuscating itself. But it's work. And it's the kind of thing that takes some pretty talented people using those tools. Now in the network area, and over the last 5 to 6 years you've seen the growth of these technologies where if you're in a security operations center and you're looking for malware on the network, you're using some type of full packet capture. So you grab all the traffic you can, you keep it for as long as you can, and then you try to either automate the search or you compress it down by capturing key pieces of metadata where you can keep a little less information for a little bit longer. But when it comes to identifying malware or hacking attacks in this venue, the fact that the command control channels can be encrypted is a disadvantage. Then again, there's behavior that you can notice. The use of TLS makes it even harder, but as I'm going to talk about later, there's still some metadata that you can use. But it presents a challenge. Finally, there are logs, and I have a question mark there, because as I was going through and preparing the talk, I mean, I had to figure out where to put my resources and how much time to spend on different topics. I am sure that if I thought about it long enough, I could figure out the effects of encryption on logging data. Off the top of my head, I just couldn't think of that. But logging data is important, and it could be important. Although, as an aside, I'm sure all of you in the industry know that the development of the security information event management tools that were so prevalent for so long were driven by mandates that you keep your logs as long as possible and as many of them as possible, which resulted in a focus in collection and storage and not in analysis. So, it's not that you can't use logs to find your hackers and the adversaries. It's just that it isn't used as efficiently as it could. But it can be a strong tool. And in fact, especially the correlation of these three factors, the endpoint, network traffic, logs, being able to pull all that together, that can provide you with a lot of insight into where abnormalities are happening in your systems and identify potential malware. How encryption plays in that, I'm just sort of honestly telling you, I couldn't pull anything up. If anybody has any ideas, feel free to jump up and let me know. So real quick, just as a proof point, in case you don't believe me, this happens to be RSA's tools, but there are tons of tools out there that can do that are capturing network traffic. And this is your typical SSL, and although you probably can't read that, I have a cipher suite there. So this is live test traffic. This is the kind of thing you would see in the wild. And so if you're seeing SSL, you can see cipher suites, you can see other pieces of metadata. You would think that it might be something that you could leverage to find potential use of SSL by malware. And in fact, when I talked about there not being a reference, a survey of the use of encryption in malware, there is a fantastic paper on identifying malware's use of TLS without decryption. And I have the reference here. I have the authors. If any of them are here, say hello. This is a very good paper. If you have, you're going to have access to these slides, go read through this. It's a fantastic effort. And in essence, what they did is they looked at the use of malware by various classes, the use of TLS by various classes of malware to protect command control data. They developed some statistical methodology and testing, and they were able to find some distinguishing features. And The thrust of what I'm talking about here isn't really what those features are. It's more that they're there. And by the way, this is without the protocol being tweaked at all. This is just the behavior of TLS when it's being used by a legitimate application versus what happens when it's being used by malware. So please, go take a look at this. One thing I want to point out, and I'm going to talk a little bit longer about this later, is the fact that they mentioned, we showed that these features can be used to detect and understand malware communication while at the same time preventing the privacy of benign uses of encryption. So this benign use, I'll come back to this later. So let's talk about being a little bit proactive here. And this is where I'm sort of half hoping somebody raises their hand and says, oh, we're already doing this. Oh, don't you know about this particular field and this particular protocol? And there are already tools out there that are making use of this. But I'd like to see this become a little bit more widespread. It's sort of a challenge to the standards community. Obviously, these protocols like TLS, IPsec, you name any security protocol out there, they're not static. There are new versions coming out all the time. So just throwing the idea out, wouldn't it be useful if there was a trusted cryptographic source tag that existed in either the server hello or the client hello in the SSL protocol or the TLS protocol? Now, you can imagine the use of that. We can already identify malware often by its behavior when using TLS, if we could actually identify this particular endpoint, the particular cryptographic module it used, maybe even if that trusted cryptographic source tag had some time information on it. This is all information that can be useful to those who are hunting for malware. We're trying to prevent these advanced persistent threats. But there's some challenges here. And this is sort of more to the meat of my talk. The challenges are time. What would you want to do if you wanted to get this started? Well, assuming, by the way, again, I'm hoping somebody will jump up and say, didn't you know there's work in IETF, in the SSL working group or the TLS working group now to add a field like this? I don't think there is, but please tell me if there's some movement underground to get this started. But assuming there's not, is the time to get it into the protocol itself, to get it accepted in industry. So this isn't something that's going to happen tomorrow just because I might get 15 or 20 people in the industry to think it's a good idea. There's also support from the industry and NIST itself. Now, I'm not saying they wouldn't support it, but the idea that we're going to enrich the metadata that these security protocols are using so that the hunters of malware have something a little bit more valuable to use in their efforts, that's going to take multiple people, multiple organizations, a multiple pronged effort to make it work. Finally, there is the privacy protection issue. Now, all of you know, if you've been to any IETF meetings, if you heard discussions, especially if you were there 4, 5, 6 years ago, and you can guess what I'm talking about, this concept of ubiquitous encryption popped up. And I forget which meeting, it was the one in Seattle, I was there, and when I heard that from the perspective of what my company now does, in the industry that my company, or the sort of the part of the security industry that my company now occupies, the idea that you could have ubiquitous encryption, my first thought was, wait a minute, we need to be able to look at network packet data. It's a fantastic tool for identifying potential malware insertion and potential attacks. If you shut that down, we've got issues. On the other hand, I can understand exactly why you'd want to have ubiquitous encryption, why you'd want to have that encryption done in such a way that it is difficult to turn off. So the idea that you would be adding metadata tags to security protocols, it may not disclose the contents, but a lot of the issues that we had recently, it wasn't about the content of information, it was about metadata. It was about how is my privacy affected if just somebody knows that I made a phone call. Not what I said during the phone call, but I made one. Well, it's the same type of thing. So there are privacy issues here, and ones that should be addressed up front. So when you say, what does that trusted cryptographic tag look like, trusted cryptographic source tag, maybe you don't want to have an identifier that tells you exactly what machine. Or maybe you do. Or maybe you want to make sure that it's protected so that only the owners of those laptops, the company that owns them, or the individual has access to it. So there are multiple privacy issues, and I can see a lot of complexity here. Finally, and this is where I try to bring it back around to the conference that we're actually attending, what would be the source of this trusted cryptographic source tag? Well, the FIPS 140 modules would be a perfect place for it. They certainly have all the cryptographic tools. There's a great place to put the keying material to make sure that the tag is trusted. Having a standardized API call with a standardized tag resulting, and having that embedded in standards related to cryptographic modules would go a long way to then convincing maybe some of the protocol standards groups to insert those fields in standard positions and standards way with, you know, expected information in them. So my guess, I'm trying to see here, that took me 22 minutes. I'm not finished, but I have gotten through the meat of my presentation. I hope now to get some feedback. I want to get questions. I want to have a dialogue. Because just to summarize, what I've done here is I'm proposing that one way for standards groups that focus and that users and communities that focus on the standard controls, in this case encryption, can play a major role with the other part of the industry, which is monitoring networks and endpoints and logs and looking for potential malware attacks. And the way that can be done is by enriching the metadata that's available for those security operations centers as they monitor networks and endpoints. So anybody here, let me know, has anybody here been involved in a standards group? Has anybody here had a conversation like that in the past? So again, I'm hoping I'm wrong and that the answer is yes and somebody will jump up, but I'm not expecting it. And that's because this is sort of a big picture thing. This is across industry segments. Just a quick story. As RSA was going from a company that focused on encryption and authentication to a company that focused on monitoring and risk analysis and providing tools for Security Operations Center, new people, new blood came into the organization. And I can tell you that those whose job it is, that those whose expertise is monitoring network traffic, looking for abnormalities, looking for those command control channels, when I would come to them and say, hey, but it's really important that an organization encrypt their data in a secure manner, in a standards-based manner, and if they're using AES 256 bits, nobody's ever going to break that. Well, their initial reaction was, I don't need to break 256-bit AES. In fact, none of the people that I'm looking for, none of the bad guys, none of the black hats that are exploiting our networks could care less if they can ever exploit AES 256. That's not how they get in. What use is encryption? Well, by the way, I have a pretty strong counter now. Encryption's very valuable. In fact, the very tools you're trying to identify use it, and they use it in a way that makes your job a lot harder. So obviously, encryption is important. But the idea that the two worlds can play together, that they can help each other, that's something that I think we need to focus more on. We need to focus more on solving that problem and of getting a dialogue started. So please, talk to me. Or just stand up at a mic and say hello. Tell me who you are and where you're from. Thank you.
I'm wondering, and I'm sure you've thought of this, but you were saying that the malware tends to exploit existing system libraries to do its SSL TLS. So if you're adding a trusted crypto source tag to that, Have you thought about the mechanisms that the OS system libraries would need to implement to differentiate between legitimate applications on the system using the system libraries and getting tagged with the FIPS inside modules, mm-hmm. crypto source tag, and malware that happened to have infested that same system using those same libraries to encrypt its traffic?
So that's a great question. And it's something I didn't go into in a lot of detail. I mean, what use is this? Okay, you can think of a lot of uses sort of off the top of your head, but there is this question. If the malware is already using existing libraries, then isn't it just going to look like everything else? Well, the answer is that if you're able to identify it as malware, and there are things that malware do that make it look different, in that case, you then immediately know where it's at. If you say, whoa, this looks like command control data. I know it's secured by TLS. It looks like command and control data. In the past, you then have to go, well, what's the source IP address? And is that really where it's coming from? And when did it come from there? And so, by the way, with a very sophisticated system, you might be taking that information from the network and taking information from an endpoint, and maybe information about the latest malware attacks and the sources of those malware attacks and what kind of machines and what kind of vulnerabilities they're using. Or the tag could tell you it happened on this machine at 9 a.m. yesterday. So that's one advantage. The other is, if you could in some way lock down the use of, let's say, a trusted cryptographic module so that malware had trouble getting to it. Now, by the way, I'm not saying I know how that can be done, but, you know, there may be situations where you could do that. Then you could do whitelisting, which means you see this trusted cryptographic tag, that's probably not malware. And by the way, you know what's going to happen is that even if this happens and your FIPS modules start feeding this tag to TLS implementations, there's probably going to be some other TLS libraries that are on the system. There might be other libraries that are used by older applications that can't quite work with the new stuff, and malware is going to go after that. But still, you can do some whitelisting. So that's another way that you could use it. But that's a very good question. And we're not really going to get a feel for that until we actually have a possibility of this happening and we have people who start thinking about it carefully. By the way, there's a big picture here, which I didn't mention, but it's this idea of services, cloud services. So in the past, a lot of what happened with an organization happened on premises. They would have their own data center, their own servers. More and more these days, they get those services from cloud providers. Those cloud providers, as they provide more and more of these services, are providing the security services as well. And in fact, some of those cloud providers are looking at providing services where literally applications talk to servers and they talk to it where it's a direct TLS connection. And they talk to it in a way that no one from the outside can even tell who's talking to who. So if you start looking at this, now the idea is literally to provide that true ubiquitous end-to-end encryption that provides real privacy. Now, in those cases, I still think malware, you know, makes its mark, but you get into the situation where having something like this might really be necessary. Because otherwise there might not be any other way to identify what's going on except for the behavior. So other questions? How many of you are involved in IETF and standards groups at IETF? Have gone to any of their meetings? I've only attended a couple. I have friends who sit on the IETF organizations that work on TLS, but I haven't gone myself. How many of you in your organizations working in your? So most of you obviously are here because you're focusing on FIPS 140 and encryption. How many of you have any dealings at all with anybody in your organization who runs your security operations center? How many of you know you have one and where it's at? I happen to know at RSA because we sell products like that and we take our customers on tours. But if I was sitting in my engineering organization building, I don't know, the latest authentication technology, I don't know if I'd know where it was at either. But trust me, they're there. Everybody's got one now. Let me see. I've got 30. See, I told you I was really planning for 40 minutes, and I was going to give everybody 5 minutes of their day back. Let me see if I can get some conversation started. How many of you think that adding this kind of metadata to security protocols that allow you to tell more, to quickly gain more information about the sources of communication, et cetera, how many of you think that's a privacy issue? Very good, because it is. It is a privacy issue. How many of you want to challenge me and say, well, your idea is never going to work because even any information is going to be a problem? Okay, good. Come up and tell me why you... Because you see, it says rants. Nobody's ranted yet.
I think pre-Edward Snowden, you might have had a chance. I think today, there's no way.
Notice I couldn't even say his name. And it's not because I saw the movie. I didn't see the movie. But I heard that it wasn't very accurate. Anyway, this is not a political statement. This is just... there's so much happening in the world today. But yeah, I agree. There is fear of nation states, not just our own, but everybody. And the idea that you'd be adding metadata that would make their job easier if they were somehow able to leverage that fact. By the way, they'd be able to leverage it like everybody else, right? The FBI would be able to, if this stuff existed, the FBI would be able to come to a company and say, hey, I think we got issues. I need to, and even though you protected that metadata and you can read it, you need to tell me what it is. So yes, there are issues.
Yeah, I think there's really two classes, or there's more than two classes, but there's really, what you're talking about here is you have the nation states that are going to try to do something like this and provide their technology to perform attacks. And then you have the, I want to call it the ransomware folks of recent day, mm-hmm. Are a totally different level. And, addressing the problem in that way, you know, where you're trying to add this or thinking of adding this tag may be useful for the ransomware side, but I think that the nation state side would eventually figure it out and figure out ways to go around it anyway. So it's, you would elevate the bar, but, you know, then the people would catch up and then the bar would get, you know, we have to do something else to raise the bar. Are there privacy issues? Obviously. And how those are handled, that would be another, you know, again, I agree with the previous comment that, you know, pre-Edward Snowden, yes, there might be a chance, but today I think there's a lot of people that are really starting to look at the privacy issues that are there.
So what about a trusted cryptographic tag that said nothing but the crypto provided for these operations was from a trusted device? Literally, that's all it said. Okay, I'll answer my own question. Well, I'm thinking of a FIPS module. I mean, you're getting your crypto.
You're putting more value in FIPS than in service.
I'm using FIPS because I'm at their conference and they asked me to speak, so I had to come up with a topic that included. I'm joking. I think a FIPS module is a great place to start because it's a standard, right, that can drive behavior, but it's not the only trusted module and it's not the only place you'd want to put something like this. Absolutely. But by the way, I can answer that. Probably this tag is going to be a decent size. It's probably going to be big enough where, even though it's only supposed to say the crypto was trusted or crypto came from some place that your organization thinks is trusted, it's still going to be another field which, yeah. Well, yeah, well, that's why I've got this word trusted. Again, it's a good question. I know it's trusted. But the idea would be within your organization, if the concept of a level 3 cryptographic module, FIPS validated cryptographic module, really does what it's supposed to do, and you could put a digital signature on it, which you could validate with a public key associated with the private keys that live in these trusted devices, then you can might get some, but that is a hard problem. And I said it at the beginning, which is that, look, cryptography does a really good job in solving problems in very well-defined situations, right? So if you say, I'm sitting here and I know no one can look at my code while I'm doing stuff, and you're sitting over there and nobody can look at your code, I can make sure that the communications is secure between us. What happens today? That's exactly the assumption that is broken when your device is hacked. Right? Somebody uses social engineering, gets you to click on a file you shouldn't click on. You know, the operating system you're using really isn't trusted because it's got a vulnerability that's been sitting there for 10 years that somebody's just found. I mean, so the problem is with the assumption. So, yeah. On the other hand, in a world where the academic barriers don't really exist, doing something like this, even if it doesn't always work, adds value. By the way, we're already detecting malware. We can already detect malware just by using the features of the protocols that have nothing to do. They're not aimed at them, but just the way they behave. So, you know, adding something else, even though it may not always work, should have some advantages. So, now 3 minutes left before my session's supposed to be over. There is no session after this. So I'll be around. I have business cards. By the way, I didn't say that. This isn't RSA, the company, making this proposal. This is me, given permission by my company, to come up with a topic and an idea and some challenging suggestions that you might want to look at. I'm trying to take the CTO title that they just gave me a year ago and actually do things that fit in there as opposed to what I normally do. So don't call up Zuli, who's our he's the chief technology officer of RSA. Don't call Zuli and say, hey, when are you guys going to do this? Who are you going to talk to at NIST? Zuli won't have any idea what you're talking about. Okay, well, thank you.